Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. Justices Johnson and Willett are participating in each of these cases but couldn't be here for personal reasons, but they will review the arguments. In the order of their appearance, the causes are 10-0523, Port Elevator Brownsville, LLC versus Rogelio Casados and others from Cameron County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 10-0526, In Re United Scaffolding, Inc., which is an original proceeding. And 10-0548, Rusk State Hospital versus Dennis Black and Pam Black individually and as representatives of the estate of Travis Bonham Black, deceased, from Cherokee County and the 12th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted to the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in the first cause, Port Elevator Brownsville versus Casados.
May it please the court, Ms. Keeney will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case presents the question of when does an employer who subscribes to the Texas workers' compensation system get the protection that the labor code gives to those subscribing employers? When it applies, Labor Code 408.001 makes workers' compensation benefits the exclusive remedy of an employee for any claims against its employer for a work-related injury. Labor Code 401.01118 tells us who an employer is, and it does it in plain and simple language. An employer is a person who makes a contract of hire, employs one or more employees, and has workers' compensation insurance coverage. Section 401.012A defines employee in very similar plain terms. An employee is each person in the service of another under a contract of hire. Port Elevator is an employer, and it bought a policy providing workers' compensation insurance coverage.
And what then part of its policy with Texas Mutual do you contend covers all employees?
The language says that it covers all of the insured's workplaces, and therefore it covers all of the insured, who is the employer. It covers all of their employees.
I mean, how does Texas Mutual's denial of coverage affect your client?
It doesn't affect it at all, Your Honor. An insurance company's mistaken denial of coverage can't establish that there is no coverage. Mm-hmm. The coverage is there, and the employer's right to assert that the workers' compensation bar remains. It's their right to assert in the negligence action that's brought.
Do you disagree that the classification of employees or the identification or the identifying language is relevant in the analysis to determine whether Mr. Casados was in fact?
Absolutely. The code classifications that are found in the policy are in the premium calculation section. That's not the coverage section of the policy. They're subject to change, they're subject to revision, and they don't control what the coverage is.
How do we read the entire policy together then to give it meaning? We can't ignore one section and look solely at the other section.
Well,
how do we reconcile it?
Correct, Your Honor. But all that does is determine what the premium is, and that is that involves the relationship between the insured and the insurer. It has nothing to do with whether there's coverage. For example, if a policyholder doesn't pay enough premium, doesn't pay the premium, that doesn't change the coverage under the policy. It may give the insurance carrier the right to cancel the policy, but the policy has very specific requirements, and so does the labor code, on how you would terminate a policy. You would have to cancel it. You would have to provide, in some circumstances, 10 days notice, in others, 30 days notice, and that's also in the policy. So the code classification has nothing to do with what the coverage is. It has only to do with how you calculate the premiums. Plaintiffs don't dispute that Port Elevator has a valid policy, and they have admitted that Port Elevator was, I mean, that Mr. Casados was Port Elevator's employee when he suffered a fatal work-related injury. These undisputed facts place Mr. Casados and Port Elevator squarely within the definitions of employer and employee under the Labor Code. Mr. Casado's status as a temporary worker doesn't change those facts.
I haven't a chance to look at this policy, but are there any exclusions or definitions as that can identify the plaintiff in this situation?
No, there are no exclusions for coverage. Well, there's an exclusion for example, maritime and things like that, but where the federal law would apply. But there is no exclusion for any particular sort of employee. And for the most part, the forms won't permit that.
So he broadly falls under the definition in the policy as an employee?
Yes, actually, I think there is an exclusion for executive officers. I think the president and the vice president of Port Elevator are excluded, and that is specifically allowed by the Labor Code under, I think it's 406.097 of the Labor Code. So there can be that sort of exclusion, but the general rule is all employees are covered. The Labor Code requires that, and the policy provides for that. The policy terms and all the exclusion forms are all dictated by the Texas Department of Insurance. This is not something that an insured and an insurer can basically selectively decide what they want to do. The Labor Code and the Texas Department of Insurance essentially dictate most of these terms. Again, in Wingfoot Enterprises versus Alvarado, this court recognized that a temporary worker can be an employee of both the temporary agency that provides the worker as well as the client employer, in other words, Port Elevator, for whom that worker performs the work. In two recent opinions, this court has recognized that the statutory definitions of employer and employee under the Labor Code create coverage for all employees of an employer that is insured under a policy. The court did it most recently in Western Steel versus Altenburg when it held that an employer who had its own policy did in fact have workers' compensation coverage that would establish the exclusive remedy bar for all of its employees. The issue in that case is not an issue here. It was this person an employee? In fact, the court held that judgment was proper on the issue of the coverage under the policy, even though the policy wasn't even in the record, because it was undisputed that the employer had a policy. These policies, by and large, are very much alike, and you don't really actually have to look at the terms. Under the Labor Code, they have to provide this coverage. The court also applied these definitions in the Labor Code in Garza versus Excel Logistics when it stated that under these statutory definitions, an employer could utilize the exclusive remedy bar as long as it had its own insurance policy that explicitly covered it. And Port Elevator has that policy. The court below nevertheless held that Port Elevator was not entitled to the exclusive remedy protection of the Labor Code, apparently accepting four arguments that were raised by the plaintiffs in their briefing below. First was that Mr. Casados was a temporary worker. The policy didn't identify temporary workers. The employer didn't pay premiums on temporary workers, and the carrier disputed coverage.
On the premiums issue, are premiums double paid?
No, they're not. As I understand it, the practice in the industry is, or at least with respect to this particular carrier, Texas Mutual, is not to charge for temporary workers on their insurance policy as long as the temporary staffing agency does have a workers' compensation policy.
So this is just some agreement works in the among comp insurers or something?
It's an industry practice.
And then the carrier that did get the premiums is supposed to pay the benefits.
Pardon?
Then the carrier that did get the premiums is supposed to pay the benefits.
Yes, although actually there is liability under either policy. The question of who has primary responsibility, where they would share it, whether they, I think the Texas Mutual's position here probably would have been that the staff force carrier was primarily responsible and should pick up the loss, but the worker could make the claim against either carrier.
You'd think this would come up fairly often, not every day, but often enough that maybe carriers would have an agreement or there would be something more than just industry practice.
I think it is really just industry practice. And a lot of it is driven, frankly, by these decisions and the requirement in Wingfoot Enterprises versus Alvarado and the requirement in Garza versus Excel Logistics that you do have to have your own policy. And, it is just industry practice at this point. There may be a dispute someday, but that's not before this court over which carrier is primarily responsible.
Is it possible for an employer to have workers' comp coverage for some employees and not others? You mentioned exclusions for principals and that sort of thing, but can you do that for the workforce?
Generally, no. Now, there is an exception that's been developed in the common law that deals with if you have separate businesses. And there are Texas Department of Insurance forms for an exclusion where you would identify a particular workplace and business that would not be covered. But you would actually, under the Texas Department of Insurance, you actually have to use one of those exclusionary forms.
If the term temporary employee is not defined in insurance policy, why can't we just decide, since it's not specifically identified, then there's no coverage for that individual? That seems like a reasonable conclusion.
Well, Your Honor, that's essentially what the plaintiffs are arguing, and that's asking this court to find an exclusion in a policy where there is no such exclusion. I think it's this court's decision in Evanston Insurance Company versus Atafina, where the court said exclusions in a policy have to be expressed in clear and unambiguous language. And the plaintiffs here cannot point to any policy language that would reasonably support an interpretation that temporary employees would not be covered. And it's also contrary to the policy of the labor code and the definitions in the labor code that simply don't allow that.
What about those, like the H.C. Beck case, which involved an OSIP, where by agreement, the contractor or the owner would provide the comp coverage, and there's no direct payment by the companies for that premium. Does that have any application to this?
No, it doesn't. And that you would have to use those Texas Department of Insurance endorsement additional exclusionary forms. You would have to fill out one of those forms, and you would have to spell out exactly how that is done. Mm. But that does happen. But that's not relevant here. There are no exclusionary forms like that at issue. The only case that the Court of Appeals cited for its ruling and that it claimed governed its decision and required the result that it reached was Garza versus XL Logistics. And that case supports Sport Elevator, not the plaintiffs. The only reason that the client who employed temporary workers in Garza did not get summary judgment was that it made the mistake of relying on the temporary agency's policy rather than its own. And this court held, no, this is not a Staff Leasing Services Act case. If you're just a with temporary workers, what you have to have is your own policy. And had that client employer proved up its own policy, the summary judgment for that employer would have been affirmed. We have that policy in this case. That's the result that Garza versus Excel Logistics requires.
Is there any allegation of ambiguity in the policy? Since the term is not defined, therefore that whole broad section must be ambiguous and you lose?
No, Your Honor, and I think the policy is very clear. The policy is clear, the labor code is clear. And this was a summary judgment against Port Elevator and a denial of the summary judgment that it sought for application of the comp bar. And again, what they would have the court do is look to the actual intent. They're saying that Port Elevator had no intent to cover these employees, and neither did Texas Mutual. That intent is irrelevant. As this court has held in, I think, at least two cases, I guess Feist versus State Farm Lloyds and Progressive County Mutual versus Sink, the actual intent of the parties to policy terms that are dictated by the Texas Department of Insurance is not relevant. And what you look to is the plain language. And the plain language here provides coverage. And there is no exclusion that can reasonably be found in any of that language.
But the plain language doesn't include the term that we're arguing about. So you want us to insert a term to give the policy meaning?
No, Your Honor. I'm not seeking to insert a term. I'm saying that under the plain language, all workplaces are covered for the insured. The insured is the employer. And what the policy provides is that the carrier will pay all workers' comp benefits that are owed, would be owed by the employer, and they were responsible for that. Essentially, the policy incorporates the labor code into it. And under the labor code, all employees are covered. If employers cannot count on the labor code to protect them from common law negligence actions for temporary employees, work-related injuries, they become more likely to do one of two things. And I'm about to run out of time. I think I'll just save that for rebuttal if the court doesn't have any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Keltner will present argument for the respondents.
If you please the court, this is a situation in which the petitioner ignores the facts and does so intentionally and relies on an application of law. If you really boil this down, and some of the briefs go a little bit parallel on this point, the real issue, I think, is this. Whether the common law prohibition against splitting the workforce can extend coverage beyond what the parties intended the coverage to be. That, I think, is the question. This court has actually answered that in several respects, and let me get to that. The other side makes this suggestion. What they say is, you can't split the workforce, therefore we did not. Now, in a very analogous case, this court in St. Joseph Hospital versus Wolf addressed the same issue. There, St. Joseph Hospital claimed that the employees of the hospital could not be vicarious for their actions because if they were responsible for the physician's actions, they would be in the unauthorized practice of medicine, which is prohibited by the statute. And what this court said is very simple, not so fast. First thing, you're confusing illegality or prohibition with impossibility. And the mere fact that the law says you can't do it doesn't mean it's impossible for you to do it. And that's precisely what happened here. This was a litigation strategy, and it's important that the court understand this. This issue did not pop up between these parties until 18 months after this lawsuit was filed. It didn't pop up in the denial of coverage. It didn't pop up when the issue was actually tried with the court. 18 months later, it popped up and just say, oh, you can't split coverage. Before that happened, there are several undisputed facts that are proved by contemporaneous documentary evidence. And under, as you know, City of Keller, those can be conclusive. And here's what they are. First off, Texas Mutual, even in its brief before you today, in its opening brief, says to you that they intentionally did not cover temporary workers. By the way, we think temporary workers ought to be covered. We think the law should require that, and in fact does. And we would agree with the MECI on that point.
How can that be done without double payment of premiums?
Your Honor.
Because both people want to be covered.
In the issues is there could be situations where there needs to be coverage for both. So I'm not so sure that it's a double premium issue for the same thing, because sometimes, as this court recognized in Garza, there is control on different aspects of the people's job. Same here. In Garza, the court went into great detail about that, as you remember in Justice Owen's decision, in saying sometimes the temporary worker was controlled by one person, sometimes they were controlled by others. Therefore, of course, there was a fact issue of who was the employer with the control.
But is there a way for the staffer to be covered and the employer also?
Yes, Your Honor.
Without there, double payment.
There is, and in, as you know, in the SL, in the services leasing, the Leasing Services Act, that can be done specifically. It's not done with temporary agencies currently by statute. As a result, many instances, in this court said in Garza, you employ two ways, or you insure two ways, I'm sorry. You insure first by the issue of if you have an express policy issued to the client company, which in this case would be Port Elevator. Second, you can do it another way. You can do it, and this is, I think, important to the background of this case and the court's eventual opinion. You can also do it through the temporary services company. But if you do, they have to be a named insured. Here's why. The experience modifier of the client company, in this case Port Elevator, had to be what the premium was based on. As all of you know, and the statutes provides and the Workers' Compensation Commission requires, experience modifiers drive the issue of what the premium is going to be. I haven't directly asked your question because I don't think the statute actually provides an answer for that.
But is there any practical answer? I mean, is of course, ideally, you want the worker covered, and then the staffing agency wants the protection, and the client wants the protection. So how can that happen without a double payment of premiums?
It can happen this way. You can assign the worker, and it's really in the assignment of worker, under the supervision of one particular person in that group pay. Make the decision that it is the client, that company, in this case Port Elevator, that is dictating all the work. Or exactly the opposite, have supervisors from the temporary agency and do it that way. So I think that's the answer to that.
Counsel, petitioner's brief says that plaintiffs have admitted that Mr. Casados was an employee of both Port Elevator and Staff Force, both in the pleadings at the trial court and in opposing directed verdict, and they quote statements in both instances. What's your response to that?
That is in fact right. We have admitted that he was an employee, and in fact that is crucial to our cause of action, and we did admit that. There's no doubt about it. The issue of the situation we're caught in is this, and it's a horrible one. To get the benefit of the workers' comp bar, there is a compact this court has recognized many times, and the courts of appeals quite often, and that is that if an employer gets a policy that covers a worker, and by the way, I disagree wholeheartedly with counsel for the petitioner on this one, 408.011 is the comp bar. It requires coverage for a specific worker. Not that you just have coverage. It is, in fact, it is very specific as to that issue, and it says recovery of workers' comp benefits is the exclusive remedy of an employee covered by workers' compensation insurance coverage. We didn't get the benefit of that. We know they didn't pay premiums. They've had to admit that for temporary workers, such as Mr. Casados. We know that they knew they didn't pay premiums, and this is terribly important. After each year, there is a true-up, and those of you who have worked in these issues know that. There is a true-up on coverage, and what you do is you try to determine who did you have working on the payroll. It true-up for 4 years, including the year that Mr. Casados was killed. They did not pay workers' compensation premiums for temporary workers. Therefore, they didn't pay it for Mr. Casados. Therefore, they're not entitled to the work bar. And the other issue is the policy requires one other thing, and it's very important to look at, and that is that, of course, Port Elevator had to be given notice of claims against the policy so it could participate in the workers' compensation process. That's part of this policy. And when the coverage was denied for Mr. Casados, and there was the insurance company says, we're denying it, and by the way, we're denying it, one, because you're not an employee, that was wrong. Then second, because we never collected a premium for you, Port Elevator stood silent. And it wasn't until 18 months after the common law lawsuit was filed that we have a response to that.
Except that 408.001 doesn't mention the word premiums. It simply focuses on an employee covered by workers' comp. So that seems to be a tangential issue to the application of 408.001 in this context.
Your Honor, that's right. And let me, I'm going to make the argument to set this up in one respect, that is the argument the petitioner is making. What they're saying is coverage does not turn on intention. It just turns on the fact that you have coverage for one employee. If you have coverage for one employee, you have coverages for all. I will take exception to one other thing the petitioner said. They said, you know, really the truth of the matter is don't look at intention. This is a state-mandated policy. That is true. There's no doubt about it. But how you fill out the policy and what you put in is not controlled by the state. And many policies, as you will look at in cases that are cited to you by both parties, turn on how they're filled out. Many of these, including the older cases as Stanton and some of the others, Western Steel, for example, did insure all employees and did so specifically. In the Bradley case versus Phillips, same issue. No filling in of classifications. Here, there is a filling in of classifications, and the policy is very precise about this. The policy says that, by the way, classifications change what we're doing here. And second, what we are covering, and she says it's just a premium, it is mentioned several times and outside the premium language. The policy goes on to say, we do exclude some people if they're not working, and it is the executives and officers of the company, as long as they are not working in the covered items in the codes. If they were, they would be covered. Now, the issue truly is it reality of the workplace where businessmen and workers reside that ought to control here, or is it a law and legal fiction? This is a little bit like this old shell game that always happens, and the issue is there's got to be a P under one of the shells, and that P is coverage, and the only thing they can say about that is resort to legal fiction when they didn't pay premiums, admitted that they did not intend to cover Mr. Casados or temporary workers because of a misunderstanding of what I think the law was. Now, they don't say that. That's my guess, I must admit.
Let me ask you while you're getting some water there, to follow up on Justice Heck's question, this has to be, there are a lot of situations just like this. I mean, this isn't going to be a unique scenario. So would it be your estimate that there are a lot of relationships out there, staff, leasing, temporary workers, situations where everybody thinks everybody's covered, but you say that they're really not?
Your Honor, I truly don't think so. Again, I would disagree with the petitioner on that, and let me explain why. Staff Leasing Services Act is very specific on what is covered and what is not. It is very easy and most, and having done this for law firm, including my own, of getting workers' comp coverage, it is easy to list the categories of employees that you wish to be covered. And it is easy to look to this court's decisions in temporary workers, and Garza is a classic example of that. And Garza tells you what policy you have to have and why, and then you just determine who you want to have covered. And the issue is, most of the time, it's going to be everybody. And the policy is going to reflect that in classifications or in a designation filled out in the form policy of that's what it's going to be.
So it's more of an E&O situation than a...
In many respects, it very much could be. There was a mistake here. There is no doubt that the general manager manager of Port Elevator, testified he thought he had gotten coverage through staff force. The coverage through staff force was not good in this case for him because he was avoiding the experience modifier for his company, Port Elevator. And that is what Justice Owen said in the Garza opinion, which is unanimous from this court, that you cannot do. It is that classic a situation. This is an factually outlier case. This issue does not come up very often, and it is bizarre. And of all the cases we've looked at, the issue of payment of premiums only comes up in a few cases. Now, the other side says you shouldn't look at the failure of premiums and cite two cases for that proposition. Stanton is one of the cases they cite, a 1940 case from the Amarillo Court of Appeals. We believe it backs us. What it says is the payment of premiums sheds light on the intention of the parties on what to cover. Now, that makes sense. That's exactly what we believe is too. There, though, and this is interesting, and Justice Green, Justice Heck, this goes to your questions. In that case, it is clear and very specific that the policy covered all employees and listed work sites, but it was all employees in Texas.
Can an employer decide it wants to cover the, let's say it's a car dealership, and they want to cover the mechanics but not the administrative staff, and get a policy that classifies those two and says, here's coverage for one, but we're not going to pay premiums, and we don't want coverage for this other class of employees. Is that permitted?
It shouldn't be, and under the common law, it is not. The issue, though, is this. As this court said in the Christensen case, and is also true in the Hatfield case, which is a Fifth Circuit case interpreting Christensen, the issue is that the defense of coverage is at the choice of the worker. If the company were to do that, the worker would have the choice of either trying to enforce the worker's compensation benefits or go after his common law benefits. That has not actually been addressed in the previous briefing to you from the other side. We have addressed it in our brief to you. The law, one of the other issues that comes up, and they make a big deal of this, is the law is encouraging everybody to be covered. And in one respect in Texas, that's true. In another respect, it's not, and I think you know that. The truth of the matter is, as you know, Texas is the only state in the country in which employers of a certain size are not required to have workers' compensation benefits. And in fact, even when we had the tort reform legislation on this issue, that was a big issue and was one of the things that was pushed by some people. The industry and various workers understandably said, we don't like the system so much, we'd like to opt out of it. Now, the opt out has a consequence. If you opt in, you get a benefit. And this court has held, and courts of appeals have also held, that you can get that benefit if you opt in. But if you do, you have an obligation. And the obligation is not so much to the insurance company or the insurance company to the employer, it is to the state. Because the state is giving a benefit for people to opt in, and what it does is it gives them an obligation to ensure there is coverage. That is why 408.011 is very specific in saying that coverage is determined by employee, not by general policy. In this case, the obligation to the state wasn't fulfilled. Because of a mistake somewhere, they didn't get the coverage they needed and admit they didn't pay for it. And both the insurer and the insured basically say, in fact, the insurer says it directly, we didn't ever intended to give them coverage for that. And in fact, they still haven't paid premiums on that basis.
What language in the policy, though, reflects this intent to exclude the temporary workers? if we're just looking at the policy, what about that reflects that intent to exclude?
Judge Guzman, I'm not so sure that it is excluding. It's not including. By doing the classifications, which they admit do not contain temporary workers, they're not included in coverage in the first place. No reason to exclude them. The question I would ask the other side is, what, and I think it's already been answered for you, what included all workers here? And the answer is, we uncovered all the workplaces.
What about the argument that because this is a standard form policy?
Yes.
As we said in FICE, it's not necessarily the actual intent of the parties that governs, it's what the actual words mean.
Your Honor.
And you talked about the policy of the state to provide this backdrop coverage for all workers to the extent the employers opt in. Whose burden is it to show exclusion?
To show exclusions?
You talked about Stanton, Christensen, and Hartfield. Are they modified by Garza and Wingfoot? Whose burden is that?
The burden, let me go through the burdens, because you asked an interesting question, and they shift a little bit, and I take it as your point. The real truth of the matter, to get the benefit of the comp bar, you have to show coverage. You have to show coverage for the employee. They deny that. They say, we just got to show coverage on one. If we cover one, we cover them all. The second issue getting to your...
counsel said we covered everybody and talks about language.
I don't... First off, I disagree that it covered everybody. And
assume it does.
If you assume absolutely it covered everybody, is there exclusion? No. Our point is it didn't include these people in coverage. It wasn't so much an exclusion, which we would have to prove. It is the individual coverage, which is their burden to prove. One additional thing, and I want to, in the dwindling seconds I have, is address the amici concerns. This is not a case about Texas covering temporary workers. We believe they should be covered. If clerical workers had not been, classification had not been included, and premiums not paid on them, the result would be the same for the clerical workers. Temporary workers are important. The comp bar is important. Splitting of workforces is important. Those are all time-honored and wise principles adopted by this court and the state. This case can be decided without doing any harm to any of those. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelvin. Rebuttal. Important to hear rebuttal.
I think plaintiffs have conceded that their case turns on the code classification part of the policy. That's the only part of the policy that they point to that they claim excludes temporary employees, and they rely on the Bradley versus Phillips case as supporting them, saying that in that case the policy didn't have any classification codes and therefore it covered all workers. They are mistaken. If you review that opinion carefully, you will see that there were classification codes, and what happened in that case was that Phillips Petroleum left out any classification code for the chemical workers. And the court in that case, which reviewed the policy terms very carefully, they are very similar to the policy terms here because it is a form policy, and found that that omission of that code classification didn't change the fact that all employees of Phillips Petroleum were covered. The claim that Ford Elevator didn't intend to cover its employees, while their actual intent is wrong, I would like to set the record straight. Port Elevator did everything that a responsible employer could have done. It not only bought its own policy, it required the temporary agency to provide it with the binder that showed it had coverage. It had double coverage. It made sure that both employers and the worker were protected under any circumstance.
The opposing counsel says you waited a long time to make that argument and to rely on the exclusivity clause.
There wasn't any reason to make that argument, Your Honor, because Staff Force's insurance company stepped up to the plate and wrote the plaintiff's counsel and said, these are the benefits available to you. There aren't, there weren't, at that point in time, there aren't very many benefits that were available to parents of children on whom they were not dependent. They got burial benefits, and Staff Force's insurance company paid into the subsequent injury fund, I think it was about $59,000, which is what they were required under the labor code to pay, because there were no, there was no spouse, there was no child who would be receiving the income benefits. So the issue was addressed. The insurance companies had properly, you know, addressed that issue.
What about the argument that there was no intent to provide coverage because there's no premium collected and there was no true up at the end of the year for a period of 4 years?
Your Honor, an audit by a carrier of the premiums owed can't determine the coverage under the policy.
I agree with that. But generally, an insurance company is not going to pay or provide coverage if they don't collect a premium. They don't give coverage for free.
No, they don't. And as I explained in the opening, Texas Mutual's policy is, as long as their insured is insisting that the temporary agency has a policy, they will not assess an additional premium on temporary workers. They would have if there had not been a policy that the temporary agency had. And so actually to say that Port Elevator didn't pay the premium is really not fair, because Port Elevator paid the cost of these temporary workers that were insured under an additional workers' comp policy. So they basically did pay for that.
In the Phillips case that you mentioned earlier, were premiums an issue, the payment of premiums?
I can't recall that right off the top of my head, Your Honor.
And then what was the purpose then for including these classifications in the policy?
Well, the purpose was simply to calculate the premium, at subject to audit, but it's not to determine the coverage.
To identify employees on whom you would be responsible for premiums?
It's for the relationship between the insured and the insurer to determine what the premium will be. It's subject to audit, it's subject to change.
How does that relate to who's covered though, who you've identified?
It does not relate at all.
So then why identify them?
Because you do have to, because insurance companies do expect to be paid, and so they do have the code classifications to calculate the premiums.
So what is the relevance of the code classifications as it relates to who is covered? Why not just put all employees?
Because you couldn't do a calculation of the premium. They basically calculated a $55,000 a year premium based on these code classifications, the number of employees. The number of employees, the types can change.
I think, Mr. Casados, you contend fit into the last broad category, operations of the...
Actually, we think that the code classifications are irrelevant, but if they were, he would fit into grain elevator operations. He was working in the grain elevator. But again, we think that that is completely irrelevant. And I see that I'm out of time. If the court doesn't have any further questions.
I think there are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Keeney. That concludes the argument, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.